This program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is The Atlantic. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from The Atlantic magazine. First today, the world's hardest bluffing game. Why are some Iraqis so good at figuring out when a person is lying? By Jason Anthony. By 4 a.m., a breeze had begun to blow across the stadium near the center of Baghdad, but Qaid al-Shikli was still sweating through his dish dasha. He was 6 hours into a championship quarterfinals match of MIBYs, one of the world's most challenging mental sports. His team, Al Sadoun, was down by 10 points. The clock was running out. When you hear the game described, MIBYs doesn't sound difficult. It sounds impossible. Assembled on a court in front of Al-Shakli's were his opponents, 45 men from the city of Najaf. Arranged in three neat rows. One of these players held a silver ring. It was Al-Shakli's job to determine which one and in which fist he held the ring, judging only by his facial cues and other tells. Al-Shakli had already made significant progress toward this goal. He and his fellow captain had narrowed the field of suspects to four. A referee in a red vest hovered nearby with a stopwatch. Each team started with just 5 minutes to find the ring, per that year's tournament rules. If that time elapsed, their opponents got the point. Now Al-Shakli bore down on one of the remaining defenders, a middle-aged man in a light blue robe. "Fists and face," he barked in Baghdadi-accented Arabic. The Najaf player stretched out his arms, fists still clenched, and lifted his head to look into the captain's eyes. He held this pose for 3 seconds, as required by the tournament's rules, while Al-Shakli scanned his face. "Talik!" the captain cried while slapping at the man's two hands in quick succession. He thought the fists were empty, and he was right. When the man exposed his palms, Al-Sadoun fans in the bleachers rose to their feet, roaring in approval. By narrowing the field to three men, Al-Shakli had earned his team a bit of bonus time, 2 extra minutes on the clock. He huddled with his fellow captain. In several earlier rounds, they'd managed to identify Najaf's ring bearer, but had picked the wrong hand and lost the point. "It was the Najaf fists," Al-Shakli told me later. They were difficult. When the captains broke their huddle, Al-Shakli called to the crowd, his arms outstretched. The Al-Sadoun fans answered with another cheer. Now he turned on one of the three remaining suspects, a young man with shaggy hair and his jacket pulled up around his neck, a common move to hide the pulsing of the carotid artery. Al-Shakli called for fists and face again, and the referee pulled back the man's hair so that his face was fully visible. For the full 3 seconds, the captain stared him down. Finally, he gestured to the man's right hand. "Jeeb," he said, "give it to me." The man opened his hand, and the stadium lights reflected at last on a glint of silver. Lying is a fundamental human act, and bluffing games of one sort or another are found in cultures around the globe. Latvian children play a ring-hiding game of their own, and Hunt the Slipper was a popular hiding and bluffing game in Victorian parlors. Across North America, indigenous groups enjoy a sport not unlike MIBYs, in which players must find bones hidden in the fists of an opposing team. The great U.S. contribution to bluffing games, of course, is poker, now a global industry worth approximately $100 billion. I covered poker for about a decade, and I've met some of the game's virtuosos in the art of spotting tells. Even so, when I first learned about MIBYs and started poring over the match videos posted on YouTube and Facebook, I was awestruck by the captain's skill. A poker player might need to study 8 other people at their table. A Mybe's captain takes stock of perhaps 45 distinct opponents, or really 90 different fists. Mybe's captains do not succeed at this task every time. But I came to understand that top players spot the ring with shocking regularity. I had to see this for myself. Last year I went to Baghdad, where the game is said to have been invented, where its players by tradition on nights during the holy month of Ramadan, after the breaking of the fast. The details of its origins remain unclear. Some say it started in the 1500s, during the Ottoman era. Others trace it back to the Abbasid Caliphate many centuries earlier. Mybe's League officials told me the modern rules began to take shape during the 1990s under the regime of Saddam Hussein, who made the game a symbol of the nation. The game endured even after Hussein was toppled. Since then, the number of teams competing has grown more than tenfold, and organized tournaments, once confined to Baghdad, now pop up from Basra in the south to Erbil in the north. Last year, in a groundbreaking move, the Baghdadi Museum hosted a public Mybe's game for women. My seat in the April 2024 match between Al-Sadun and Najaf was by the judge's desk. Sitting to my right was Jassim Al-Aswad, the judge himself, a grand figure in a green dishdash. Al-Aswad is the greatest Mybe's player in living memory, and his fame among Iraqis extends beyond the game. In 2008, when the country was mired in sectarian violence, he marched a team onto the Bridge of the Imams, which connects a neighborhood that contains a holy Shiite shrine to a Sunni stronghold across the Tigris. The span had been the site of many of the Iraq War's greatest civilian calamities, and had only just reopened. One night, Al-Assad brought out players from both sides of the river, who met up in the middle to play for peace. Al-Aswad, now in his early 70s, seemed to enjoy his new role on the sidelines. He took evident pleasure in shouting to the fans and playing with the kids who ran up to him with their fists closed, hoping to fool the great man. He also kibitzed with his old friend Ali Al-Lami, the octogenarian retired captain of the Al-Habibia team who sat nearby. We watched together as the teams from Al-Sadun and Najaf launched into their next round of their march. It was after 5 a.m. Now Al-Sadun would hide the ring. Supporters brought out a stretch of gold fringe fabric to obscure the team's choice of ring holder. In Mybe's, defensive strategy is just as crucial as offense, and the placement of the ring unfolds with Masonic complexity. A team captain might put his hands over each player's fists in turn, either placing a ring inside one of them or pretending to. Sometimes a captain places extra rings and steps back to scan the teammate's face. Have the men with rings begun to sweat? Are their fists uneven? Using all of this information, a captain makes a second pass, perhaps a third, until he has removed all the rings but one. When Al-Sadun had finished and the players settled in their rows, the Najaf captain stepped onto the court. As they made their rounds among the rows of Al-Sadun men, Al-Lami leaned across me. "Jassim," he said to Al-Aswad. "Second row, in the green, near the end. Eh? It's him. Only I can't tell which fist. "Right fist," Al-Assad replied. "I've played that guy before." We were at least 20 feet away from the nearest player, and the man they were talking about was maybe another 30 feet from there. I squinted at the man they'd identified, my eyes younger by decades than either Al-Lami's or Al-Aswad's, couldn't make much out. Neither could Najaf's star captain. When he stopped in front of the man in green to study his fists and face, he gave no sign of seeing anything unusual. A minute or two later, the Najaf captains began eliminating players. They counted out several in the second row. But before they could continue, One of those dismissed cried out, "Bat," which meant he had the ring. It was the man in the green, Dishdasha, the one Al-Lami and Al-Aswad had pegged from about 50 feet away. And just as Al-Aswad had predicted, the ring was in his right fist. A Maibis captain's talent can seem miraculous or even suspect to the non-Iraqi viewer. But if Maibis were a sham, if its matches were scripted in advance, like some kind of Iraqi WrestleMania, then the private conversation I had just observed would have to have been pre-written too. Maybe suggests a more compelling possibility, which is that the art of peering into people's faces and uncovering deceit may be honed to astonishing precision. Some researchers believe that people can be prodigies at lie detection. Other scholars aren't so sure these so-called wizards are real. Mark Frank, a communication professor at SUNY Buffalo, is in the former camp and helped create some of the most ambitious lie detection studies to date. But when I showed him some clips of the Maibis captain's feats, even he was taken aback. Frank wondered at the circumstances that had led them to develop such extraordinary skill. A curious pattern had emerged from the early work on wizards, he told me. A large number of them had experienced a tumultuous childhood. Some were the children of alcoholics. Later research found wizards who were raised in institutions or in violent environments. Scholars theorized that for these people in particular, the ability to read adults' expressions when they were young might have been life-saving. The past two generations in Iraq have endured an almost unthinkable progression of wars, mass migrations, and humanitarian crises. Even in the relative calm of recent years, bombings still occur with regularity. That, Frank told me, is an environment ripe for producing people who are good detectors of subtle clues. When I got a chance to float this theory to actual Maibis players, they were unimpressed. Maibis has been around longer than the recent conflicts, Al-Shikli, Al-Sadun's co-captain told me. And one generation of modern players grew up in the 1970s, when Baghdad was a mostly peaceful modernizing oasis. I grew up watching other captains. I played a lot. That's how I learned, Al-Shikli said. He grabbed a ring for a demonstration and closed his fist around it. Then he pointed to a spot between his second and third knuckle. There's a tendon there that fastens to the dorsal interossei muscle to bone. It's almost invisible, but Al-Shikli said it sometimes bulges out a tiny bit when someone has the ring, and captains learn to spot it only through extensive practice. His willingness to share this tip surprised me. Over months of interviews, I'd learned that most Maibis players won't discuss their strategies at all. But even a captain's favored methods may lose efficacy as the match wears on. Ali Al-Lami warned me that the Maibis changes after sunrise. Finding the ring can get more difficult, he said. Whether from the return of fasting or sheer exhaustion, players may become impassive. The captains, too, may start to wilt. One viral video on TikTok shows a captain, toward the end of a 15-hour match, probing his opponents in the daytime heat, as run down as a senator in the final moments of a filibuster. The quarterfinals match I saw finished shortly after 9 a.m., when Najaf scored its 13th point and won the game. Fans streamed to the exits. Food stalls closed. Players boarded buses. Eventually, a few men came over to where I was sitting, picked up the judge's desk, walked it back into the small stadium office where it stored. If this had been a neighborhood game, the winners would have received, by tradition, a plate of sweets. In the Maibis major leagues, however, no such prize is offered. For once, all of the Najaf players were empty-handed. Our second story, When Mick Jagger Met the King of Zydeco, by Rhea Hart. The story I'd heard was that Mick Jagger bought his first Clifton Chenier record in the late 1960s at a store in New York's Greenwich Village. But when we talked this spring, Jagger told me he didn't do his record shopping in the Village. It would have been Colony Records in Midtown, he said, the biggest record store in New York, and it had the best selection. Jagger was in his 20s, not far removed from a suburban London boyhood spent steeping in the American blues. I pictured him eagerly leafing through Chess Records LPs and J&M 45s until he came across a chocolate brown 12-inch record, Chenier's 1967 album Bon Ton Roulé. On the cover, a young Chenier holds a 25-pound accordion the length of his torso, a big mischievous smile on his face. Bon Ton Roulé is a classic Zydeco album, showcasing the Creole dance music of Southwest Louisiana, which blends traditional French music, Caribbean rhythms, and American R&B. This was different from the Delta and Chicago blues that Jagger and his Rolling Stones bandmates had grown up with and emulated on their own records. Although sometimes taking the form of slower French waltzes, Zydeco is more up-tempo. It's party music and features the accordion and the rub board, a washboard hooked over the shoulders and hung across the body like a vest. Until we discovered Zydeco, Jagger recalled, I had never heard the accordion in the blues before. Chenier was born in 1925 in Opelousas, Louisiana, the son of a sharecropper and accordion player named Joseph Chenier, who taught his son the basics of the instrument. Clifton's older brother, Cleveland, played the washboard and later the rubboard. Clifton had commissioned an early prototype of the rubboard in the 1940s from a metal worker in Port Arthur, Texas, where he illustrated his vision by drawing the design in the dirt, creating one of a handful of instruments native to the United States and forever changing the percussive sound of Creole music. Within a few years, the brothers were performing at impromptu house dances in Louisiana living rooms. They'd begin playing on the porch until a crowd assembled, then go inside, pushing furniture against the walls to create a makeshift dance hall. Eventually, they worked their way through the Chitlin Circuit, a network of venues for black performers and audiences. They played Louisiana dance halls, where the ceilings hung so low that Cleveland could push his left hand flat to the ceiling and stretch his back out without ever breaking the rhythm of what he was playing with his right. Influenced by rock and roll pioneers such as Fats Domino, Chenier incorporated new elements into his music. As he told one interviewer, I put a little rock into this French music. With the help of Lightnin' Hopkins, a cousin by marriage, Chenier signed a deal with Arhuli Records. By the late 1960s, he and his band were regularly playing tours that stretched across the country. Despite the insistence from segregationist promoters that Zydeco was a black sound for black audiences, he started playing churches and festivals on the East and West Coasts where people who'd never heard the word Zydeco were awestruck by Chenier. He came to be known as the King of Zydeco. He toured Europe, he won a Grammy for his 1982 album I'm Here, performed at Carnegie Hall and in Ronald Reagan's White House, won a National Heritage Fellowship from the National Endowment for the Arts. He died in 1987 at age 62. This fall, the Smithsonian's preservation-focused Folkways recordings will release the definitive collection of Chenier's work, a sprawling box set, 67 tracks in all. And in June, to mark the centennial of Chenier's birth, the Louisiana-based Valcor Records released a compilation on which musicians who were inspired by Chenier contributed covers of his songs. These include the blues artist Taj Mahal, the singer-songwriter Lucinda Williams, the folk troubadour Steve Earle, and the rock band The Rolling Stones. In 1978, Jagger met Chenier thanks to a musician and visual artist named Richard Landry. Landry grew up on a pecan farm in Cecilia, Louisiana, not far from Opelousas. In 1969, he moved to New York and met Philip Glass, becoming a founding member of the Philip Glass Ensemble, in which he played saxophone. Landry also embarked on a successful visual art career photographing contemporaries such as Richard Serra and William S. Burroughs and premiering his work at the Leo Castelli Gallery. He still got back to Louisiana, though, and he would occasionally sit in with Chenier and his band. After he proved his chops the first time they played together, Chenier affectionately described him as that white boy from Sicilia who can play the zydeco. Landry became a kind of cultural conduit, a link between the avant-garde of the North and the Cajun and Creole cultures of the South. As Landry remembers it, he first met Jagger at a Los Angeles house party following a Philip Glass Ensemble performance at the Whiskey a Go-Go. The next night, as luck would have it, he saw Jagger again, this time out at a restaurant. They got to talking. At some point in the conversation, Jagger goes, "Your accent. Where are you from?" I said, "I'm from South Louisiana." He blurts out, "Clifton Chenier, the best band I ever heard, and I'd like to hear him again." "Dude, you're in luck," he told Jagger. Chenier was playing a show at a high school in Watts the following night. Chenier was in Los Angeles playing what had become an annual show for the Creole community living in the city. The stage was set at the Verbum Dei Jesuit High School gymnasium by the edge of the basketball court. Jagger was struck by the audience. "They weren't dressing as other people of their age group," he told me. "The fashion was completely different. Of course, the dancing was different than you'd normally see in a big city." The band was already performing by the time he and Landry arrived. When they walked in, one woman squinted in Jagger's direction, pausing a moment of possible recognition before changing her mind and turning away. Chenier was at center stage. As they moved across the black and white keys of his accordion, his name embossed in bold block type on its side, Cleveland stood beside him on the rub board. Robert St. Julian was set up in the back behind a three-piece drum kit, just a bass drum, a snare, and a single cymbal. Jagger took it all in, watching the crowd dance a two-step and thinking, "Oh God, I'm going to have to dance. How am I going to do this dance they're all doing?" He recalled, but I somehow managed to fake it. At intermission, a cluster of fans, speaking in exciting bursts of Creole French, started moving towards the stage, holding out papers to be autographed. Landry and Jagger were standing nearby. Jagger braced himself, assuming that some of the fans might descend on him. But the crowd moved right past them, pressing toward Clifton and Cleveland Chenier. The next time Mick Jagger and Richard Landry crossed paths was May 3, 2024, the day after the Rolling Stones performed at the New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Festival. A meal was set up at Antone's in the French Quarter by a mutual friend, the musician and producer C.C. Adcock. Adcock had been working on plans for the Clifton Chenier Centennial Record for months and was well aware of Jagger's affection for zydeco. He waited until the meal was over, when everyone was saying their goodbyes, to mention the project to Jagger, and without hesitation, Landry recalled, Mick said, "I want to sing something." As the final addition to the album lineup, the Stones were the last to choose which of Chenier's songs to record. Looking at the track listing, Jagger noticed that Zydeco Sont Pas Salés hadn't been taken. "Isn't that like the one," Adcock recalls him saying, "the one the whole genre is named after? If the Rolling Stones are going to do one, shouldn't we do the one?" The Stones' version of Zydeco Sont Pas Salés opens with St. Julian, Chenier's longtime drummer, playing a backbeat with brushes. He's 77 now, no longer a young man Jagger saw in Watts in 1978. "I quit playing music about 10 years ago, to tell the truth," he said when we spoke about it this spring, "but you wouldn't know it by how he sounds on the track." Keith Richards' guitar part, guttural and revving, meets St. Julian in the intro and builds steadily. The melody is introduced by accordionist Steve Riley of the Malmö Playboys, who told me he tried to play it like Clifton, you know, freeform, just from feel. It's strange that it doesn't feel stranger when Jagger breaks into his vocal sung in French Creole. His imitation of Chenier is at once spot on, yet unmistakably Jagger. I asked him how he'd honed his French pronunciations. I actually tried to write songs in Cajun French before, he said, but I've never really gotten anywhere. To get Zydeco Saint Pas Salé right, he became a student of the song. You just listen to what's been done before you, he said. See how they pronounce it, you know? I mean, yeah, of course it's different, and West Indian English is different from what they speak in London. I tried to do a job, and I tried to do it the way it was traditionally done. It would sound a little bit silly in perfect French. Zydeco united musical traditions from around the globe to become a defining sound for one of the most distinct cultures in America. Chenier, the accordionist in The Velvet Crown, then introduced Zydeco to the whole world, influencing artists across genres. When I asked Jagger why, at age 81, he had decided to make this recording, he said, "I think the music deserves to be known and the music deserves to be heard. If the song helps new listeners discover Chenier, to have something like the experience Jagger had when he dropped the needle on Bon Ton Roulé, that would be a welcome result." But Jagger stressed that this wasn't the primary reason he'd covered Zydeco Saint Pas Salé. Singing to St. Julien's beat, Jagger the rock star once again becomes Jagger the Clifton Chenier fan. "My main thing is that I personally like it. You know what I mean? That's my attraction," he said. "I think that I just did this for the love of it, really." The author Rhea Hart is a writer, documentarian, and music industry professional living in New Orleans. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of The Atlantic. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Atlantic is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. Have a great day.